So I feel very honored that Ayasudama has asked me to give the Wednesday night talk tonight, and I thank you all for coming out to hear Nathaka Bhikkhuni, which has 2 or 3 months, speak. So I hope whatever happens tonight will be of use and benefit to you. And I was going to do something of a mixture of styles, where I'd been ordained as a seminary and had lived for 2.5 years as a Nirodharam in Chiang Mai, Thailand. And there we had been trained to give talks that were very much based on things that were said in the sutta. So to start out with something straight from the word of the Buddha. But the talks that I had sort of grown up listening to in my own Dhamma practice were more from the Thai forest tradition, where the emphasis is more on speaking just based on personal practice of the Dhamma, and just speaking from the heart without much preparation or no preparation at all. So I thought to just do a little bit of both today. The sort of rationale for starting out with something that comes straight from the Buddha is a bit of, I guess, safety or guarantee that everyone in the audience gets something that's substantial and useful, regardless of the skill or lack thereof of the speaker. So, out of compassion for you, I think I will start with something straight from the Buddha, because then you will walk away with something that will be definitely guaranteed of benefit. And then whatever comes after, well, we'll just see. So, what I wanted to read out was something that is actually recited every fortnight. I wrote around when we, every fortnight, as the bhikkhunis do their Patimokkha chanting, the seminaries also do a recitation of their training rules and the Saikya rules, and also dhammas that are crucial and central to life as a monastic, especially a monastic in community. And one of the discourses that we review every 2 weeks is the discourse on the 6 ways of conduct to be remembered, or the Sariniya Dhammas, because this is what conduces to a smooth and harmonious monastic community, which is a very important element as a support in one's Dhamma practice. And so as I read this, I'd actually like for us to expand our understanding of this, not just as the monastic community, but of Sangha members, but the monastic community at large, so everyone living here. I consider everyone part of the community, and that everyone can also reflect on this as a guide and teaching in how to live together, like the kutis here are named, like milk and water, blending together harmoniously, not like oil and water. So I chose the rendering of Kantipala Bhikkhu in honor of my first real full-length talk in Australia. And this is, for some of you, his name may be familiar, but for those who are not, Kantipala Bhikkhu did a great deal of service in helping to establish Buddhism in Australia. So in honor of him, I'll use this rendering from his book, Banner of the Arahants. So this is the discourse from the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Sixes, number 12. Thus have I heard. At one time, the Exalted One was staying near Savatthi at the Jeta Grove, Ananta Bindika's monastery. Then the Exalted One addressed the bhikkhus, saying, "O bhikkhus," "Lord," they replied, and the Exalted One said, "Bhikkhus, these 6 ways of conduct are to be remembered, to be cherished and held in great esteem as conducive to sympathy, to unbroken and harmonious concord." What 6? Bhikkhus, here a bhikkhu's friendliness in bodily action is ever present towards his fellow monks openly and in private. This is the Dhamma, way of conduct, to be remembered, to be cherished, and held in great esteem, conducing to sympathy, unbroken, and harmonious concord. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu's friendliness in verbal action, speech, is ever present towards his fellow monks openly and in private. This is the Dhamma to be remembered, to be cherished, and held in great esteem, conducing to sympathy, unbroken, and harmonious concord. Again, bhikkhus, A bhikkhu's friendliness in mental action, thought, is ever present towards his fellow monks, openly and in private. This is the Dhamma to be remembered, to be cherished and held in great esteem, conducing to sympathy, unbroken and harmonious concord. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu in respect of whatever he receives as due offerings, even to the contents of his bowl, does not make use of them without sharing them with virtuous fellow monks. This is a Dhamma to be remembered, to be cherished, and held in great esteem, conducing to sympathy, unbroken and harmonious concord. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu in company with his fellow monks, trains himself, openly and in private, in the rules of conduct, which are complete and perfect, spotless and pure, which are liberating, praised by the wise, uninfluenced by mundane concerns, and favorable to concentration of mind. This is a Dhamma to be remembered, to be cherished, and held in great esteem, conducing to sympathy, unbroken and harmonious concord. Again, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu dwells with his fellow monks, openly and in private, preserving the insight that is noble and liberating, and leads him who acts upon it to the utter destruction of suffering. This is a Dhamma to be remembered, to be cherished, and to be held in great esteem, conducing to sympathy, unbroken and harmonious concord. Bhikkhus, these six ways of conduct are to be remembered, to be cherished and held in great esteem as conducive to sympathy, to unbroken harmonious concord. Thus spoke the Lord. Delighted, those bhikkhus rejoice in the Exalted One's words. Delighted, we may rejoice in the Blessed One's words. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So this is a discourse that really talks about, you know, the nuts and bolts of how to live it together harmoniously. And we see that it's a range of levels. So to review in more plain speak and not discourse speak, the six ways are first to have bodily action that is filled with metta. So this is translated here as friendliness, but we may be more accustomed to hearing the word loving kindness. So the word in Pali is metta, and that can be translated either way. And then secondly, verbal action or speech that is filled with metta. Third is mental action or thought, which is filled with metta. And fourth, to share your wealth whenever you get it. And fifth, to keep the rules of the Vinaya, so the rules of monastic discipline, for the benefit not just of yourself, but of your fellows in the community. And finally, to develop that insight, that really highest insight that is liberating, of not just your own suffering, but also other people's suffering. Because when one acts with this wisdom, one is able to live a way that doesn't tread on the toes of anybody else. So ultimately, the highest Dhamma would be the wisdom of liberation. However, we can start where we start, because really that's all we can do. And out of all of these six, the thing that I wanted to focus a bit more on is the working with our thoughts in a way that's skillful, in a way that is both in public and in private. What I find lovely about this discourse is that it stresses that it's not just our actions that are in public. It's not just our words or our speech in front of the people we live with. And it's not just our thoughts that we have when we are facing them. But it's the thoughts we have in private about them. It's the words we say behind their back. It's the things we do when they're not looking. These, you may think that because they don't see, because they don't hear, because they don't, unless they have psychic powers, because they don't know, what you're thinking, these have an effect. They have a cumulative effect on the energy in the community and on the harmony in the community. So it's something that really is just imperative to really try to develop, not just for your own happiness, but for the happiness of everyone you live with. I find that actually in my own experience, it's the thoughts that are very tricky, because speech and action, you know, it's a bit more coarse. By the time it can get out your mouth, by the time it can get out in your actions, something has been bubbling there in your thoughts before. And if you can develop ways to be skillful about observing those thoughts and observing the process in which those thoughts develop and grow and flow out the doorways of your mouth, the doorways of your whatever parts of your body you use to do bodily action, before it flows out, if you can just keep it there inside, at least at first, just keep it inside. And then, even better, to actually not have it inside, to not have those negative thoughts about your fellows, to not have those angry thoughts about whoever's sitting next to you, or, you know, whoever's in the kitchen, or anything that can happen in the monastery. If we can become more and more skillful about that, our lives in the monastery are actually happier. And I've seen the change. I mean, even though I've been ordained only for almost 3 years, that's really nothing compared to, you know, all sorts of people who are ordained for much longer. But I've seen, actually, that it can change, it can develop. And it's much easier to live happily in a community, whichever community it may be, community in Thailand, community, you know, in Australia, just any community you're in. It's a lot easier to keep those wholesome mind states for more of the time. If one becomes more observant of how the process actually works. So it was actually very helpful for me the other night. The first time I tried to light my wood stove in Waterfall Kuti, having been city mouse, you know, city nun, coming to live in the wilds of Australia, having to learn how to, you know, not just, we actually just never had to deal with them. That's not true. Actually, in my monastery, there were wood fires in the kitchen, and so people did use wood fires, but I somehow managed to escape having to deal with the scary wood stove. But now I must learn. And luckily, I have people who have given me good advice, and I have managed to learn. But the first night was unsuccessful in terms of lighting the stove. But it was successful in terms of seeing a great metaphor for thoughts and how they get kindled and how they grow. So as I was trying to light this little wood stove, you know, I was told you should start with stuff that's easy to burn, like paper or little sticks. And if you're desperate, the commercial fire starter, white cubes of magic stuff that just completely erupt into flames immediately. So, needless to say, it did not take me long before I felt, okay, I'm desperate, I'm going for the white stuff. And boy, that thing, it just, you know, it just lit up into this huge roaring fire immediately. And I said, huh, lighting a fire isn't so hard after all. And yet, do not be deceived. It flared up into this huge flame for a little while, but then, not long after, it just died out. And the other stuff hadn't caught on fire yet. Even the little sticks hadn't caught on fire yet. And especially the bigger sticks, the bigger pieces of wood, were completely untouched. They were, you know, they were just like oblivious to the flame that I thought was so effective. So that was kind of a dampening experience. But it made me think about the thoughts I was having, because coincidentally, that night, I was bothered by something that someone had said. It was just actually a pretty minor thing, but it had gotten to me. It had really started to eat away at me, just, you know, these thoughts of, can't believe she did that. How could she have done that, you know? Well, didn't she know that that's like inappropriate, or didn't she know that that is a, saying that thing would actually cause me some sense of, I guess, discomfort or inconvenience, or, you know, there's this whole little chain of thoughts that can just go up in flames pretty fast. So I thought to myself, okay, fire has started. Fire in the mind has started. You got some angry thoughts going on here, and they're catching, this flame is not dying. It's actually growing. What's going on here? So I thought, okay, it's just like the real fire. You know, I'm adding the stuff that's easy to burn. I'm putting in little pieces of paper. Every time I think, how could she have done that? You know, shouldn't she have known? All these little things. These are just like, these are fire starters. I mean, if you start a sentence with, how could she? She's not supposed to. You know, she should have. These are the fire starters in your thoughts. These are the ones that are going to immediately go up in flames, because already there are assumptions there. There are assumptions there that you know what's right and they are wrong. And they should not do things that are wrong. They should not do things that hurt you. You know, these are the things that you've sort of set it up already. Set it up for it to go up in flames, just like a nice little teepee of sticks or whatever method you use to start your fire. So, I mean, once you set that aflame, it's really going to go up because it's built for it. So how do we deconstruct our thoughts? How do we tease them apart? Well, recognizing the ones that are your fire starters. What are your habitual thought patterns that always cause you trouble? What are the habitual sentences that start out a certain way that if you complete them, always lead you to trouble? Start to notice these things and start to see how quickly it can go. I mean, if you just complete one sentence, if you just let it go that far, she shouldn't have done that. I mean, that's already enough for you to feel bugged, enough for you to feel bothered. And then once you let that go, it has an energy that has a momentum, because these thoughts, they come really quickly, and they're like little magnets for more thoughts of the same kind. So if you just let that one go, another one's going to come right up. She shouldn't have done this. She really shouldn't have done this. How could she have done this? They just add up. That's how it is. It's like when you add that paper to the fire. If you just add that one piece of paper, it burns out pretty fast, actually. But the problem is, if you keep adding another slip of paper in, another piece of dried stick in, just another one, just another one, just another one, then the flame never dies. It just keeps going. It just keeps having new food. It just keeps having something to burn up. So if you start having those little thoughts, know that they're individual thoughts. It's not one big bad thought. It's little bad thoughts. Little bad thoughts, one after the other. So you're just adding little bits to the fire, again and again and again, until the fire really catches. And then it catches something bigger. It's not just the paper that's on fire now. It's actually the larger sticks that are on fire. So once that gets going and that turns to something that becomes a hot ember, it's a lot harder to put out. So if the earlier you catch it, the easier it is. And what I found actually that night, what really killed my fire actually was putting on a stick that was too big for the flame. So even though I had this nice so-called looking flame going, because I put in the big stick too fast, it overwhelmed the fire, killed it. So you don't want that when you're actually trying to build a fire. That's not the thing to do. But if you're faced with a big anger fire in your head, that is the thing to do. The thing to do is to get a big lump of something that's going to overwhelm the fire. So I thought to myself, as I was lying in bed completely cold, but having totally warm and angry thoughts in my head, I was like, find the big log. Find the big piece of wood that's going to put this out. And I thought, okay, what are these like big reflections, you know? That can make me not be angry at this person. Excuse me. And I thought, okay, all beings are suffering. I mean, it seems like such a platitude, but if you really think about it, you know, okay, as much as this person really bugged me and said something I thought was completely unskillful, can't believe she did that, but she's suffering because she's alive. You know, she's just another being out there that's also suffering. No matter what she does, whether she's a wonderful person, a not nice person, a person I like, a person I don't like, a person who just rubs me the wrong way, or the person that, you know, I find I really click with, she's just another person. She's just another person out there who's alive and therefore stuffed. Gonna die, gonna get sick, gonna get old. She's, you know, she's just someone out there who's suffering and doesn't want to suffer too. So I put that log on my little angry flame for a while, and oh, okay, yeah, okay. And for that moment, I felt my anger die down. It's like, okay. But you can't sustain that for so long unless you're really skilled. The energy of the, but she shouldn't have done that, is much stronger. So again, it's like, she shouldn't have done that. The little paper gets fed to the fire again. And then if you're not mindful, many papers like that, you know, start feeding the flame again. But then when you catch yourself, you're like, whoa, I'm like totally adding fire starter here. You say, okay, let's find another stick, something else. Okay, maybe not that big log, because sometimes when you think the really big thoughts, the really, you know, big, expansive, everybody's suffering thoughts, when you're really kind of angry, you're not quite ready for that. So you need maybe a bit of a smaller stick, but a stick that's still big enough to overwhelm the fire. And so another one I found useful for me is the stick of, she doesn't know. You know, she doesn't know that by saying that, that would hurt my feelings. She doesn't know. So she doesn't know, what could she have done? So maybe she didn't know, and so she just said it. She didn't really mean any harm, but the harm was done because it bugged me. But she didn't know. And most people, when they do things, you know, they're really not out to get you. They're for the most part, especially in a monastic community, for the most part, people don't mean harm. They don't really mean to make you feel bad. They don't really mean to hurt you. They don't really mean to be rude. Just at that moment, because they were maybe not mindful, and maybe all sorts of other reasons, maybe they weren't raised the same way you were. Maybe for them that didn't sound hurtful. Maybe for them that's just a customary speech pattern they have. There are all sorts of reasons that make people say what they say or do what they do when they do it. And so at that moment, they didn't mean you harm. But they did, whether it led to harm or not, at that moment they didn't mean it. So if you can put that stick on your fire, okay, at that moment, you know, what else could she have done? At that moment, she felt that was the right thing to say. She said it. At that moment, maybe she was mindless or whatever. She said it. What else could she have done? There's nothing else she could have done. And so when you think about it that way, certainly when I think about it that way, it really helps to put out the fire a little bit, at least for another minute or two. And so, you know, it's not as if you can just turn on and off anger. You know, if you're not there yet in your practice, it's something you have to work with. It's something that's a process. And so you try your best to interrupt the process as much as you can. You know, try to put the bigger sticks on that fire as much as you can. And every time the kindling goes in, the little bits go in, you recognize, oh boy, making the fire worse. And you can feel it. I mean, it's not that hard. Anytime you can feel your anger get a bit more, you know, fire is getting worse. Don't want fire. At least when you know that fire is no good for you, then you can take steps to try to reduce it. So I find for me the thing that was very helpful. I remember a few years ago when I really, really wanted to ordain, and I was really, really, really like trying to get advice or hear feedback from some monks in Thailand. And I was really, really, really sort of hurt by just the kind of lack of interest, or, you know, just a bit of what I perceived as a lack of interest in the opportunities that women have or didn't have. And I remember going to see my teacher and being like, okay, how do I deal with feeling so upset like this? And what he told me was that whenever he reflects on causes and conditions, it makes his mind really peaceful. So to credit the source, that was the Jayasaro, he gave me this great advice. And I've really turned to that. I've used that a lot. You know, when something's really bugging you, if you reflect on causes and conditions, and it sounds like just another, you know, catchphrase in Buddhism, causes and conditions. It sounds a bit airy-fairy. But basically how I break it down, what it means to me is that everything has a cause, and whatever it is at that moment, whatever it is that person said, or what the opinions they have, the views they have, it comes from something. In the words of Julie Andrews in Sound of Music, you know, nothing comes from nothing. That thought is there for some reason, and it couldn't be any other way. You know, those monks had that view for some reason. What, their background, their way they were brought up, you know, just some reason led them to have that view, and it couldn't have been any other way. So when I think about it that way, it's just, what's there to get mad about? I mean, it's like, what else could they do? How else could they have any other thoughts? I mean, the causes and conditions led that to be the way it was. And so when I reflect like that, it really helps me to make peace with, like, whatever words or thoughts or, you know, attitudes are coming out of someone else. It's just to think, well, you know, couldn't be anything else. Whether I like it or don't like it, it couldn't be anything else. So, as I was looking out the window, and there's the great thing about Waterfall Kuti is the view, isn't it? It's that great view of just nature being nature. You know, just seeing the big tree being the big tree, and the big old rocks, whatever they're called, gorge maybe is a technical term, but anyway, the rocks being rocks. And I asked myself, you know, how come I never say, hey tree, like, why are you swaying? Or, hey rock, why are you reflecting the light? You know, you don't. It doesn't bug you. Even if the light gets into your eyes, it's not like you're like, rock, how dare you? You know, that's so inconsiderate of you. How dare you reflect light straight into my eyes? You just, you know, it's just rock. Rock being rock. Tree being tree. And actually, I laugh at myself because, you know, no, it's not true. It's not that I never argue with nature. So you can see the level of my wisdom. I remember once in my monastery in Chiang Mai, when there is a certain period every year where lots of leaves fall. And so you sweep, and then they fall again. And so one day I finished sweeping the road, it looked all clean, and I just, you know, looked up at the tree and I saw another leaf coming down. And I was like, how dare you? No, stop. Stop. I just finished sweeping. And I was getting upset at the tree for, like, losing its leaves when it's the time to lose its leaves. So I caught myself and was like, okay, not so good. Not very clever to do that. I mean, it's just the tree being a tree. I mean, what you gonna do about it? So when I think of that image, and I think of just the tree being the tree, I mean, gravity being gravity, autumn being autumn, leaves fall, and just, you know, if you don't argue at a tree, next time somebody bugs you, just pretend they're a tree. I mean, pretend that they're just a tree being a tree, a rock being a rock, and doing what they do. So sometimes the wind blows and the tree sways, okay. So sometimes something blows the person and causes them to say something. That's just the wind causing the tree to sway. That's just something, some cause, some condition causing the person to say something, whether you like it or not. So if I do that, you know, I find myself able to just let go a bit of that big old habit of judging. You know, judging. And just allowing the person to be what they are. You know, they're just them. They're just what causes and conditions cause them to be at that particular moment in time. And I find a lot of peace from the reflection we do every day before we have our meal. The one that's about the four elements. So the translation actually that I'm more familiar with is not the one that we do every day, but the way that I say it in my head is that the person eating this food is just composed of four elements, just parts of nature going according to causes and conditions, empty of self. So it's just, we're just that, we're just parts of nature going according to causes and conditions, empty of self. So then that means the person next to you is just a part of nature, just going according to causes and conditions, equally empty of a self. They can't control what they say. It's causes and conditions that cause them to say what they say. You know, they can't control the way they say it, because causes and conditions leads them to say it the way they say it. So what can they do? What can you do? Nothing. That's great. It's nothing. Nothing to do. So I think that once we get more familiar with kicking in these reflections, when we see the angry thoughts rise up in our heads, the flame starting to burn, the flare up, because you know they don't die that easy. Even when you have those embers in there, they look like they're almost gone. You see that, just that little spark of red, you blow on it, it can come up again, it can flare up again. So be careful with those angry thoughts, even just the little ones, even just the annoyances, the like, ugh, the ugh, you know, that just that ugh, every time someone does something that doesn't quite please you. That little ugh, that little ember in your head, if you blow on it, if you add stuff that's going to feed the fire, it can flare up. You have a big old fire in your head, and boy, is that a pain in the half to put out. So try to see what works for you. Find the reflections that can cause you to make your peace. And actually, another way maybe to approach it is to find the things that sort of should be struck in from your vocabulary. There are certain words that I find that are just trouble words. You know, words like should, or words like supposed to. And every time I say that, any time I have a sentence in my head that has the word should in it, it just leads to trouble. So whether it's I should, or they should, or he should, or she shouldn't have, he shouldn't have, should have known, shouldn't have done that, should know better, my God, how long have they been ordained? You know, these kind of thoughts, yeah, they're just bad news. So if you know that these are words that cause you trouble, then it helps if you actually try to weed them out of your head. Weed them out every time you see yourself using that sentence, I should have come to work meeting. Well, I mean, you know, yeah, should is so punishing. What I like actually, what I found interesting was that even in that sutta I just read out, there's no word should in what he said. The Buddha never said you should, you know, think of your fellows with a mind of metta. He said, it's like maybe the translation is in English, I don't know what it is in Pali, but it was a passive voice. It was to be. This is something to be done. It's like this would be the skillful thing to be done. So if you're skillful, you would do it. But if you're not yet skillful, you know, then you wouldn't. So it's not like you should. You should makes it sound like you don't measure up if you don't do it. But it's just, okay, this is the skillful thing to be done. And if you do it, then you won't have disharmony in the community. So it's just the language of cause and effect, not the language of judgment. And the other thing I found interesting was in the way that monastics are supposed to behave, or lay people, anything, there's never this sense of the Buddha telling us this is what you should do. But he tells us what our duties are. This is the duty of a junior monastic to a senior monastic. This is the duty of a disciple to a teacher. This is the duty of a teacher to a disciple. This is the duty of, you know, an abbot to his monastic community. This is the duty of a friend to a friend. They're just duties. If you don't do your duty, you don't do your duty. Simple as that. There's no judgment. There's no, you're bad. You're bad for not doing this. You're bad for not having done your duty. It's just you didn't do your duty. So, if you do it, it means you've done your duty. If you didn't do it, means you're derelict in your duties. Enough said. So it's just cause and effect. If you do your duty, there will be good consequences. If you don't do your duty, there'll be less good consequences. So it's just very simple. No judgment. So I try to take that as an example. Especially, I think it's probably true, what they say about how in the West people are much more harsh on themselves, more apt to be critical, judgmental of themselves the most, in fact. So yeah, I mean, catch yourself. Every time you say, I should have done this, you just replace that. Just substitute with, you know, it was my duty to do this. Did I have a good reason to not do my duty? If yes, okay, be compassionate about it. But if no, realize that I didn't do my duty and I didn't have a good reason not to. See how I almost said I should have. See how easily that one slips into that language. But don't say that. Don't say I should have done it. But I didn't do it. Didn't have a good reason. Okay, I'll take the consequences. So then it becomes a much more clean and angst-free way to live. if you weed out the word should from your mental vocabularies and your vocabulary in dealing with others, then it's a lot easier for yourself and for other people. Because we can only be what we can be, you know? We can only do what we've been trained to do. We can only do what we're accustomed to doing, what we've built up the habits for doing. And if we haven't built up the habits, then, you know, what can you do? That's just how it is. I find it very lovely in the Thai language that there isn't a word for, like, when someone's, like, not a, what I guess in English you would say, you know, they're not a nice person or they're mean or they're bad or, you know, that kind of thing. But actually in Thai, the word that they use is, this is a person who doesn't have good habits. This person has bad habits. Not the person's bad. It's not a bad person. It's a person with bad habits. It's a subtle difference, but it actually makes the world of difference. And if you can see yourself in the same way, every time you feel you don't measure up to your own holier-than-thou standards, well, you're not a bad person. You're just a person who has a lot of habits that may not be so skillful. So habits can change. It's just about retraining our habits. That's all there is to do, really. And when you think about it that way, it becomes much more possible, much more doable. It's just habits. Habits are flexible. And even though old habits die hard, doesn't mean they don't die. It just takes a bit of effort and repetition. A lot of repetition, actually. And habits can change. They can. They're malleable. They open. If you allow yourself that chance to let your habits change and not feel like, oh, I've always been this way, so I always will be this way. Oh, you know, it's just really hard to change. Well, yeah, it is hard, but it's possible. And it's not so hard if you just keep at it. Just sheer repetition is probably the secret to success. So yeah, sheer repetition of replacing the unwholesome with the wholesome. So I find that every time we start to judge, one thing that helps me is another conversation I had. I was asking Ajahn Tiradhammo about, like, what do you do when you have, like, this sense of righteousness, of, you know, how could they have done this? It's not about me personally. I don't care that they did this to me, but it's the principle of it. It's the big P, capital B, principle of it. You know, it's not, I don't feel, you know, I'm not taking this personally, but I just feel like, you know, you just shouldn't treat other human beings that way. It's the principle of the matter. And I was asking whether that was really just ego in disguise. And he just gave me this look that was like, you got it, kid. Kind of like, yeah. Yeah, it's just every time you think you want to hide behind these little ideal notions of defending the principle of it. Yeah, but whose principle? You know, whose idea of right is it? There is such a thing as the UN Declaration of Human Rights. But I must point out to you that it is it is a man-made document, which was not ratified by every country, I don't think. And I remember one of my first jobs out of university was working in U.S.-China relations. And this was kind of a hot issue, this whole sense of human rights. Like, America was always kind of bad-mouthing China for having bad human rights record. And the Chinese were always like, well, you know, our definition of human rights is different from yours. You know, free speech and, you know, that kind of thing is not as important to us when you have like a billion people to feed. The most important human right for our government right now is to make sure our people are fed and clothed and have their, you know, basic needs met. That is the most important human right. And so for them, they kind of felt that it was a completely, like, you know, different way of looking at things. That maybe the so-called human rights of this big declaration were not as important as more basic human rights at that time of their development. And so, you see, there isn't such a thing as universal principles of right, universal principles of human rights. They're all subjective. They're all just points of view. And just because you get a lot of people to agree with you doesn't make it universal. It's just a guideline, but it's something that's open. So I actually think that the only universal declaration of human rights is, you know, Noble Eightfold Path. That's human rights. Right view, right intention. We just chanted it. So you could probably just complete the sentence, but I'll go through it anyway. So right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right stillness. So these are more than arguing over what the human right you are defending or the principle you are defending. It's really your own principle. It's really your own idea. I mean, the only thing that's really universal is the path of practice that's going to take us out of suffering. So that can be something that can be agreed upon because there's just universally felt effects of following that path. So part of that path is getting, you know, the right view. So the right view is to realize that there is no other. You don't have your own personal right views, none of your own little ideas, unless they actually accord with what is true. It's just a view. It's just your opinion. It's not a capital P principle, it's just your little p principle. And your little p principle may not be the same as someone else's little p principle. So just because you think that it's appalling that they did that, you know, how could they? Well, they could, they did. Because they didn't see it the way you did. They didn't hear it the way you did. So then we open our hearts to that possibility that someone else, raised with a different background, different culture, different way of looking at things, you know, they're just not going to have the same assumptions as you do. So if they act on those assumptions, they can be doing it with a completely different idea of what it is they're doing from the way that you perceive it. So we have, as we all can tell, very little control over other people. So really the thing you do is to train your own perception to perceive that difference and allow for that difference the other people may have. And it really helps, I think, to be able to do that because every time I catch myself being appalled or just being indignant or self-righteous, you know, it always stems from just a difference in assumptions that I have and the other person may have. And try to going back and seeing, okay, what are my assumptions here? What are my assumptions? And how true are they? What intentions does that other person have had? So quickly we plaster on our ideas of what their intention are. It's like the other week when we went to that meditation group with Bhante at that Thai restaurant. There was like that music going on, and it was like just few notes of music. But for me, immediately, it sounded like that nursery rhyme. I don't know if it's an American one or a British one, but the one that's like three blind mice, you know, three blind mice. And every time those notes would go, instantly in my head, I'd be like, three blind mice. And they were just notes. They were just notes of music. But how quickly, and I couldn't stop it. I tried to be like, just hear the sound of sound, you know, and all that, you know, just hear sound of sound. But no, I heard sound as three blind mice immediately. And I found, actually, that's exactly what we do with our perceptions about other people. You know, they're singing these notes to us. They're just singing, you know, just notes. But we immediately, we put on three blind mice to it, which is like, can be like, oh, really rude. You know, sometimes we have three blind mice that says, really rude. You know, how could they say that? But it was just plain notes of music, plain words that were spoken. To them, it might not have been three blind mice. It could have been, you know, four crazy cats. I don't know. It could have been anything else. For them, it might not have been meant to be rude. But we add the three blind mice. We add the rude label. We add the, you know, appalling label to whatever it is people say to us. And if we recognize that, oh, it's just something we add on, then we can peel it off. We can take off the label of those thoughts or those words. So they say what they say. We label it, but if we catch ourselves, we can peel it off. We can peel it back to whatever those pure, bare words were and just leave it at that. They just said that. And if we can do that, we can drop it. And if we can drop it, we can feel just such a sense of relief. Like, oh, I don't have to be bugged about this anymore. It's just, you know, they just said what they said, and that's it. So the more that we train ourselves to do that, the more we can go to bed angry and then wake up fine. Have you ever done that when you went to bed angry? And you woke up and you just continued. You just left off where you picked up where you left off. You went to bed thinking, oh, how could she have? How could she have? You wake up and you're just like, oh, how could she have? And you just keep going. That's like not the great way to start the day. But if you start training to take away those thoughts or to replace them with more wholesome thoughts, then you can see the difference in how you wake up in the morning following an angry night or, you know, something like that. If you can wake up and just be like, oh, today is another day, then it's amazing that you can drop it. When I was a kid, I was quite the grudge holder, you know, I was like, you know, if someone did me wrong, I just kind of, you know, every time I passed them in the hallways, just immediate, like, sense of ugh would rise up in my heart. And I realized that it was just a lot of suffering to be a big old grudge-bearing person. And I noticed the difference when it's easier now for me to just see that this person is not the same person, actually. That's another reflection that I find useful. If you see that this person who bugged the heck out of you the night before was also, you know, empty of a self, moments happening one after the other, that was just a moment that happened last night. And that moment, that person did this. But this morning, that person could do this wonderfully nice thing to you. And so you just appreciate that nice thing that person does to you without being like, well, yeah, she's nice to me now, but boy, did she say something mean yesterday. You know, you drop it. You say, okay, different person, different moment. And it's great because when you're in a monastery, you just can't get away from the people you live. You know, it's great when you realize that actually, you know, they're not the same person. So you don't have to feel stuck. You don't have to be stuck with this person who still lives here, stuck with this person who keeps coming back, stuck with this person. You know, you don't feel stuck because you're not the same person. So that person who really bugged you yesterday at 4 p.m., at 4:30 p.m., different person. You know, and the less you can shave down that gap when you don't identify that person as the same person. If you know that you can become like 4 p.m., bug the heck out of me, 4:01 p.m., different person. If you can do that, the more you can do that, then the more people don't bug you for so long. Because not the same person, haha. It's like you open that opportunity for them to be forgiven and to just start afresh, start anew. And you can just enjoy the good things that they do for you and try to notice those good things. Because it's really a gift to yourself, frankly, when you can reflect on the good deeds of other people. And also when you see that, you realize actually how when you do act skillfully, it's really a gift that keeps giving. Just a kind act, a small kind act, is a gift that keeps giving. A small harsh word is like a pain that keeps coming back. So even though, you know, in the big scheme of things, we're all responsible for our own suffering, etc. So in that case, whatever I say, whether the other person gets bothered or not, that's really their responsibility. In one sense, yes. But in another sense, I mean, unless you're enlightened, then yes, you know, like harsh words will have an effect on the other person. And it's an effect that keeps coming back, because every time that they replay that conversation in their head, you know, you hurt them again. So that's something that really is good to be mindful of. Anytime you're about to say something that's a little harsh or just a little unskillful or even a lot unskillful, just remember that this is something that's going to hurt them, not just now. It's going to hurt them again and again every time they bring up that conversation. So that might help. That might help when you have the impulse to say something, just to let out, vent out some frustration. Just, you know, think of the compassion of, this is something that's going to hurt them again and again. So that might help to break it a little. And in the same way, think every small act of kindness you do is a gift that can keep giving to that person. So like our visiting monk, Venerable Ekagadai, who was just here last week, he has no recollection of this. You know, when he showed up, he just said, I look vaguely familiar. Gee, where had he seen me before? But I had a very clear recollection of him, because about 2.5 years ago, when I had come to Australia the last time, and I had just been a seminary for like 8 months or something, so, you know, just feeling really kind of green and like, you know, just not really sure what to do with myself. And I had gone to a talk that Ajahn Brahm gave, and they had set up a seat for the monks and then a seat for me, like on the same platform. So I was like, whoa, like I'm in like the nun seat. And just feeling a bit like, oh boy, what do I do with myself? And I remember Venerable Ekagata, he made sure that someone would set up my place and I would have water. It's just such a small thing, but for me it felt like he treated me like another monastic. You know, he just treated me like I was a real monastic too. And that just really, like, it really touched me. And it was just the smallest, you know, just normal kind act you would do for a visitor kind of thing. But for me at that particular time, it really just made me feel at ease and welcome, and just like, oh, I'm a real nun. Who has my real nun water bottle next to me? You know, like something small like that can actually mean a whole lot. And so when he showed up, you know, like I remembered that. And it was like a gift that just kept giving to me, because then I remembered him with a heart of appreciation and kindness and a heart of wholesomeness. So every time you do a kind act for someone else, what you do is you give them a beautiful memory that they can bring up. Because every time you think of someone's good act, it just makes you happy. You know, it just makes you feel good. Wow, nice person. So if that reflection can help, you know, every time you're about to do something that's not so skillful, remember that actually if you do something skillful, you would really, really be helping this person for the long term. So that reflection I find very, very helpful. And it's something that encourages us to do those small little bits, you know, just the small little things in the daily routine. When you see the toilet paper and it's almost out, you bring an extra one into the cubicle, you know, just small little things like that. If we just do a little bit of that, a lot, it adds up. And it's something that helps other people have wholesome mind states, because, you know, it's just every time that someone does something that makes you feel bad, isn't that there that part of you that's like, I don't ever want to do this to someone else? So yeah, remember that. Remember, yeah, when I was a kid and like maybe my parents would do something that I really didn't like, like write this letter, when I become a parent, I won't do this. I actually wrote something up like that, I remember one time. And so yeah, if I do that little mental note, you know, in daily life, when you do feel that someone has treated you wrong, use that in a useful way, in a skillful way, to be like, well, okay, without getting into a big angry fest at them, just remember to yourself, this is something that made me feel badly. I hope I don't do this to someone else in the future. I hope when I'm in that position, I don't do this to someone else. And just kind of remember that. And that can also be a way to use whatever happens to you as a teaching, and to really be able to use, you know, interactions that may not be so pleasant as a teaching. The teaching of, you know, how not maybe to act, what you might not want to do. And to do it without being judgy about it, without being like, oh, you know, I don't ever want to do that. How terrible of that person. I mean, don't go into that kind of mind frame. But just, you know, just to note yourself that, huh, that kind of action does not lead to happy results. Mental note. Remember that. And then hopefully that will be something that comes up in your mind when you are faced with that situation. So this is just a random medley of thoughts that I had about thoughts. How meta. Thinking about thinking, you know. But it's really so powerful, our thoughts. So I hope that maybe anything in this talk will encourage you to learn to understand how our thoughts work. And understand how we can influence those thoughts and shift them, move them towards what is wholesome and what will lead us to greater happiness and what will lead our fellows and our community to greater happiness. Because really we are such wonderful supports for each other in this path that is not always easy. But hopefully if we can keep a heart of mutual supportive intent, you know, a sense of wanting to help each other, even when the going gets tough, even when things bother you, even when other people bother you, but to know that we're all in the same boat, frankly. So it's probably best to help each other out as we bail ourselves out of what is really just a whole lot of suffering. So on that note, I'll end this talk, and I hope it will be of benefit to you. So I thank you for your attention.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.